to social psychology. Today we will be talking about two important aspects of social psychology, leadership and group decision making. But before that, I would like to draw your attention to the Studierendenbefragung. Yesterday we were informed that about 6,000 students had started to participate, but we are looking for some more. And as they look at the participation numbers per department, I would really hope and like that as many as possible psychology students answer the Studierendenbefragung. So I also uploaded a new set of the slides today, so that you can directly click on the QR code. And the Psycho Adventsabend, I think it's next week, Wednesday, there's an Advents party, and the Fachschaft is inviting all the students to come and participate, but also to donate some cake or cookies or whatever you have. And you can also click on the QR code or put this into your browser and then provide what you will bring. Yeah, I will certainly come by after the disputation. I have a doctoral viva from 6 until 8 o'clock and then we'll say hello. Okay. Last week we talked about group behavior and group performance in particular. So let's briefly talk about these three multiple choice questions. Young Jemina has just started singing lessons. According to social facilitation studies, her singing is probably better at this stage when she sings A, when she's alone, B, at a family gathering, C, in a solo at the school concert, or D, on the bus. Yes, please. When she's alone. She has just started singing lessons, so we are probably not talking about well-learned routine tasks. And in these situations, when others are around, the dominant response that is increased or fostered by the arousal because of the physical presence of others may lead to the wrong performance. While studying human efficiency using a rope and a dynamometer, Ringelmann found that the dynamometer broke when 8 people were pulling the rope. Each person pulled a little more as others joined in, or each person pulled a little less as others joined in, or people got annoyed because there was a social loafer. See, each person pulled a little less as others joined in. Social loafing. That's what we found in the studies by Ringelmann, Ingham, Livinger, and all these people, and we differentiated between process loss as motivation and coordination problems, and social loafing is a motivation problem that occurs when we don't particularly value the group and when we don't particularly value the task. Suppose that, in an exercise, your psychology class had to come up with as many household items as they could that commenced with the letter W. One half of the class worked as individuals and the other half as an interacting group. If the group output was poorer than the sum of the individuals, you would have a fairly clear example of divisible tasks, social loafing, task taxonomy, or attribution bias. Yes, please. Social loafing. Thank you. What was the difference between social loafing and free riding? What's the key difference? Yes, please.
With free riding, you then contribute anything to the group. As social loafer, you kind of like do something, but you still don't give a maximum.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Maybe that's because of my examples of the math test or math problem to be solved and you let the expert in the group solve it. But free riding could also mean that you contribute a little bit, but not your maximum performance. So I would see the key difference as identifiability of the individual contribution. So in social loafing, we typically have situations where people contribute on a rope or shouting or put their individual ideas in a computer and then it's gone. So you think or know that your contribution is not identifiable. In free riding, people know that their contribution does not matter, and whether it's identifiable or not, they will exert a little less effort or no effort at all. Okay. So then let's talk about leadership and decision making. So we will start with leadership, and I will start with a historical classic approach of leadership seeing as a great person theory, looking into traits or other characteristics of the person. Then we will look at what leaders actually do and what research has found here. And then we see leadership more in context of the situation or the group. And then we move over to group decision making and focus on two aspects: brainstorming in groups and group think. The leader of a group is the person who has the most impact on group behavior and beliefs. Very simple definition. The one person that has the most impact. It can be an officially appointed leader. It can be an elected leader. It can be someone who is not appointed or not elected, but this person may have influence over the others because of their level of expertise or because everyone admires this person. And the first group of theories that started looking into what makes leaders effective or what makes people more likely to become leaders is a so-called great person theory. And this suggests that leaders possess particular characteristics. They excel in abilities that meet the group goals. They have strong interpersonal skills, high motivation, certain personality characteristics, such as being confident or optimistic. And in general, we can say that although certain personality traits are indeed often associated with leadership, there are too many exceptions to support an explanation of leadership purely in terms of personality. About 10 years ago, Tim Judge and his colleagues have done a big meta-analysis, and they have looked at all the studies, hundreds of studies that have been conducted in this trait approach area, and they found that extraversion is one of the factors that contributes to people becoming leaders more likely. So if you subsume all the evidence, then maybe extraversion, being outgoing, to like being with other people and speaking in front of other people, etc., is the one characteristic that consistently shows that leaders have them more as non-leaders. A problem with the personality approach, obviously, from a psychological perspective, may be that we cannot train this. So leaders from this approach are born and not made, and this is always a little bit pessimistic. And one example of this is physical characteristics, such as physical height or the tone of your voice. And this was, I think, in the New York Times a couple of years ago, up until the election of George Bush. There were 38 elections, and in 33 of these elections, the taller candidate had won the election. So physical size apparently is something that we associate with leadership, and therefore it's more likely that we will become a leader if we are tall. But Donald Trump is also tall and was taller than Hillary Clinton, but it's not that physical characteristics or personality characteristics differentiate between good and bad leaders. So it's more likely that we see leaders who are male, who are tall, who speak in a deep voice, than finding short women, for example. But that does not mean that tall people are better leaders. And the same is true for all sorts of personality characteristics. So being highly motivated makes it more likely that you will become a leader, but not necessarily that you are a good leader. And therefore, and this was researched mainly between 1900 and 1940. And then people stopped doing this type of research because there were too many leadership traits that some studies have found and other studies have not found to be associated with leadership. And this meta-analysis from Tim Judge 10 years ago reinvigorated this field a little bit, and now using the Big Five personality framework, we can understand a little bit better which factors are indeed associated with leadership. But from the 1940s on, psychologists started looking at what leaders actually do and not how they look or how they are. And there were two schools in the United States that both at about the same time studied the same things, the Ohio State and the Michigan University schools of leadership. And they basically found very similar things but gave it different labels. And the one school called it task leadership versus social leadership. An effective task leader is efficient, directive, and knowledgeable, and focuses on how the task, how the job is getting done. Sets structures, goals, monitors the things, etc. An effective social leader is friendly, agreeable, and concerned with feelings. So these types of leaders are more socially oriented. They want harmony in their teams. They want to resolve conflicts early. They want to make sure that their people are happy and motivated and look for their needs, etc. Sometimes a group has different leaders for each of these tasks. Sometimes the same person can serve both roles. But the main research in the 1940s and in the 1950s was looking at, okay, what do leaders actually do? And then factor analyses have led to these two factors. And then leaders were a little bit similar than in the trait or great person theory approach, categorized as either being person or task oriented. And the question was, which type of leadership is a better type of leadership? And then in the 1960s, the situation was brought into the picture. So leadership can best be explained as an interaction of one's leadership style and whether we are more person or more task-oriented, and the demands of the task, of the job. And depending on this, one leadership behavior or style would be better than the other. And the most prominent model in this area of situational leadership is Fred Fiedler's model of leadership effectiveness, and this is called the contingency model, which means which leadership style is effective is contingent upon the situation. And Fiedler also made this basic differentiation in people-oriented or socially-oriented, or I think he called it emotion-oriented leaders and task-focused, task-oriented leaders. And he used an interesting instrument that he called the LPC scale. LPC stands for Least Preferred Coworker. So when you complete this scale, and it's basically a number of attributes in which you should use to describe a person, but you are asked to describe the one person in your team that you least like working with. And Fiedler's argument was that if a leader describes this one person he or she likes least to work with in negative attributes, then this person would be task-oriented. But if a leader describes even this least likable person in more positive attributes, then this person is, the leader is probably more relationship or emotion oriented. Yes, please.
You said least preferred co-worker?
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's why the scale is called this way, but it's
I
a.
Just did homework,
no. It's co-worker, but not co-worker in terms of colleague, but the person that you as a leader lead in your team. So essentially, it's a subordinate. Okay, so with the LPC scale, we can determine whether someone is task-oriented or people-oriented. And then Fiedler said whether task or people orientation is good and leads to high performance This depends on situational control. And we can have situations of high or low control, and task orientation is good and most effective in situations of high and low control, whereas emotion-focused or people-oriented or socially-oriented leadership is better in situations of moderate control. So now, how do we determine whether a situation is high or low in control? For this, Fiedler suggested three key elements that determine whether we have a situation of high or low control. The first element is leader-member relations in general. So except from the least preferred co-worker in your team, how are the general relations between leader and his or her followers or subordinates? Is there generally a good understanding, high level of trust, good communication, frequent interactions, etc.? Or is the situation generally characterized by poor leader-member relations? That means high mistrust, only formal interactions, many conflicts, etc. And the situation can, of course, either be high or good in terms of leader-member relationships, or less good or low in leader-member relationships. Then the next factor, and you can also group it just the other way around and put position power first and task structure third and leader-member relationship second. So we have three factors that we combine in every possible way, and then we will always end up with eight different combinations. And the second factor that Fiedler considered was task structured. Is the task itself well structured and tells the employee what to do? Or is it a very complex, unstructured, ambivalent type of job that does not automatically tell the worker or the employee what they need to do? The assembly line would be a perfect example of an extremely highly structured task. Working in the creative design industry, where you have think about new problems every day, is probably a perfect example of a less well-structured task. And the third factor is position power. To what extent does the leader control rewards? To what extent can the leader punish his or her subordinates and employees? The example of very high or perfect position power is the military. In the army, the next higher level ranked officer has perfect position power and can give rewards and punishments. In business organizations, typically position power is also relatively high. In organizations such as universities, where the dean does not necessarily have perfect position power and cannot automatically give rewards or punish poor performers, because deans are elected for 2 or 3 years, and then it's the next professor who gets dean. Because we have the Senate, because we have the department's meeting that typically decide on important things and not one person alone. So in universities, we probably have situations of medium position power, and I would say situations of low position power would be any sort of organizations that are voluntary. If you are a volunteer in the fire service, or if you volunteer in a charity organization, you can leave every day you want. And that makes your leaders or the leaders of these organizations having very little position power over the people they lead. So, and these three factors can be combined. And as I said, that leads us to eight different combinations. And there are situations of high situational control in which all three or at least two are high, and situations of rather low situational control when all three or two are low, and then something in between where we have moderate situational control. Yes, please. Yes, that's right. But Fiedler was a little bit, I would say, peculiar about this. So I'm not 100% sure whether he had very good theoretical reasons for explaining why some situations were a little bit higher up than lower. And I'm not sure whether this is theoretically well justified. But yes, you are right in terms of the combinations. And the interesting thing is that it turned out to be true. It turned out to be empirically also the case. So this is the dotted line is what Fiedler predicted after having asked a number of experts. So when do you think is a high LPC score, and that means people orientation or social orientation, when is a high LPC score related to the group performance, the effectiveness as an effectiveness measure? And the dotted line is the experts' predictions. So here, for example, the expert said, in a situation of very high situational control, when task structure is high, leader-member relations are high, and the leader has high position power, then a high LPC score would be negatively related to group performance. Or to put it differently, in these situations, task orientation would be better. And the same is true for a situation of absolutely low situational control when all three factors are low. Also then, did the experts predict a negative correlation between the LPC score and group performance? And in situations of moderate control, you see that there are positive correlations. And the blue line is the results of a meta-analysis that Fiedler conducted with 78 studies. So let me see. In 1965, 1 year after the theory was published, there were 78 studies that had been conducted applying the contingency model, and Fiedler summarized the results of these studies. And as you can see, the blue line pretty well matches the experts' predictions. So indeed, we see negative correlations in situations of relatively high and relatively low situational control between the LPC score and group performance. And in situations of moderate control, we see positive correlations of between 0.1 and 0.4 between a high LPC score and group performance. Okay, any questions? I skipped one theory because it did not so nicely fit into the historical approach, first looking on how people are, then looking at what people do, and then bringing the situation into account. Yes, please. High LPC score means high people orientation and low task orientation. But thank you for asking, because I forgot one thing. Fiedler has been criticized for... Do I have another slide? No. People has been criticized also for two reasons. One reason is that Fiedler also did not believe that leadership behavior was amenable or a factor that could be trained. So according to Fiedler, you should either try to change the situation, make the task more clear, or work on the relationships, or have means to get higher position power of the leader, or to replace a leader by someone with a different leadership style. And obviously, we would think that, yes, we can train people and we can help people adjust to the situation. But the other more methodological criticism was related to the LPC scale, because typically in most studies, the LPC scale for between 20 and up to 40% of the participants completing it were delivering scores in the middle of the scale. So Fiedler could not say whether these people were task or relationship oriented, and therefore the theory would not apply. And it's always a problem if a theory does not apply to 20 to 30%, 40% of the population. And it may be because of the LPC scores scaling, but more likely it is because many leaders are falling somewhere in between. And it's not so easy to say, I'm clearly task-oriented and I don't care about my people, or the opposite, saying, yeah, I'm very much concerned with my people's well-being and harmony in my team, but I don't really care on how the job is getting done. Many leaders are somewhere in the middle and have an eye on both the people and the task. Okay, and I skipped this type of research that was conducted before Fiedler by Kurt Lewine and colleagues in 1939. And obviously we have to know that in 1939 World War II had started and the Americans were heavily opposed to the Nazi regime, and this research a little bit was conducted in the spirit of showing that democracy is the better, the superior system. So in effect, the leaders found out what they wanted to find out. But on the other hand, they also went great length to scientifically do a correct study. So what they did is they studied 10 and 11-year-old children who were working in after-school clubs. And they introduced leaders playing different roles. And the leaders were either playing an autocratic, a democratic, or a laissez-faire leadership role. And Lewine and colleagues trained, young people of about 18 year olds who went into the clubs and worked with the children for 2 hours an afternoon. And Lewine and colleagues trained each of these people in each of the leadership styles and then rotated them around the clubs. So they wanted to avoid that any findings were due to one particular leader having learned a leadership style particularly well or not. That's why every leader learned to play every leadership style. And Lewine and colleagues wanted to avoid that any finding was due to one specific club and maybe the social mix-up of the children playing in this club or whatever. So the leaders with every leadership style were permutated and attended every club in different leadership styles. The autocratic leader was instructed and learned to take no input from group members, emphasized their authority, and assigned group projects arbitrarily to the children, so that they said, you three today, you will work on this and you work on this. The democratic leader discussed the proposed activities with the children before they made the assignments and allowed the children to make their own decision, and he encouraged development of an egalitarian atmosphere. And the laissez-faire leader did not do much. They rarely intervened. They let the group members work by themselves. They didn't do much supervision. Results showed that, or the outcomes that Lewine and colleagues looked were on satisfaction, so a social well-being factor of team or group or children's viability, and performance. And they found differences in both aspects. The group with an autocratic leader spent as much time working on their projects as did the children in the democratic leader groups, but the laissez-faire groups who were not supervised spent less time on their projects. So in terms of performance, autocratic and democratic leaders seemed to have the same level of performance, and there was lower level performance in the laissez-faire groups. When the leader left the room, however, work in the autocratic leadership condition dropped off. It stayed or remained similar or the same in the democratic condition, and it even went up a little bit in the laissez-faire groups. So it appears that the democratic leaders were able to produce a type of acceptance. Remember the session on social influence that we have. Private acceptance to the persuasion attempts rather than just public compliance. And the democratic leaders seem to have led to this private acceptance of the rules and norms, whereas the authoritarian leader only produces public compliance as long as the leader was around. And the children who worked under autocratic leaders showed also more reliance on the leader. They complained more, and they demanded the leader's attention more than in the democratic condition. So, proof that democracies are better than authoritarian systems. And it was a very basic study, and it was a study with 10-year-old children, and as I said, you have to see that in the context of the U.S. democracy at a time when there was a clear enemy in Nazi Germany, and Kurt Lewin obviously was a researcher in a democratic tradition. But what I do like in this experiment is this permutation of different people around different clubs, so that you can at least rule out some alternative explanations. But it was obviously not a double-blind experiment in which the researchers did not know which group they were just measuring, and the Confederates also did not know which role they play. That would have been very difficult in this experiment anyway. Okay, and the final aspect or comment on leadership is that leadership is not only determined by an individual person as a leader and some other individuals who are followers or subordinates or employees, but essentially leadership is a group process, because in almost all contexts, leaders also share the same identity as the ones that they lead. Leaders are also group members. And a lot of research has been conducted in the last 15 years that showed that leadership prototypicality is one key variable that determines whether leaders are effective or not. And group prototypicality means that the leader represents what the group stands for. And there's another prototypicality construct in the leadership area, which is leadership prototypicality. This is also well researched and has consistently found that when a leader fits our stereotype of what a good leader is or what a good leader does, then this leader is also more effective. But in terms of group prototypicality, we are not looking at does the leader fit the general stereotype of being a good leader or not. We look at the extent to which the leader represents the group and stands for what the group resembles. Sometimes it can be the group average, sometimes it can be the best group member, but the important thing is that the prototype can also change. Say, take political parties. At a time when the Social Democrats, for example, in Germany, see their biggest enemy in the conservative parties, in the FDP or the CDU, automatically the person in the SPD will become more prototypical, who is a little bit on the left of the political spectrum of the party, because then the differences to the outgroup are increased. Whereas when the Social Democrats see their main enemy on the left side of the spectrum and they want to get as many votes as possible from the Linke, then someone being more right of the Social Democratic spectrum would be more in line with the leader, with the group prototype that the SPD voters would see ideal for winning the next elections. So a group prototype is not a fixed and stable property of the person or the group, but it's flexible. And I don't have any slides for this because there's also not so much research on it, but together with Alex Heslam and some other colleagues, we are currently doing a little more research on this, and we have just concluded with a project on the identity leadership inventory that we validated in 20 countries with more than 5,000 people. And Heslam and colleagues are saying that group leadership is more than just being a good prototype of the group. Most research has focused on group prototypicality, and a typical study is the one by Haynes, Hocker, and Dark in 1997. We, together with Johannes Ulrich and Olli Christ, published a study in 2009. In a typical study, you ask group members about how prototypical the leader is, and then you ask them whether they trust the leader more or whether they are more likely to help and support the leader. And what we normally find is that prototypical leaders are better, particularly for those group members who are strongly identified with the group. And in this experiment, Hock and Collie, or Haynes, Hock and Duck, differentiated between low and high group salience. So whether the group itself was important or less important to the group members. And they manipulated whether the leader was prototypical or less prototypical. And as you can see, when the group is not so important, there's little difference in leader prototypicality and his or her perceived effectiveness. But when the group was important, when the group itself was salient, then prototypical leaders are seen as much more effective than non-prototypical leaders. In the study with Johannes Ulrich, we have a survey of employees, and we found the expected two-way interaction we had a survey of employees. We asked them about their own identification with their team. To what extent do you like being in the team? To what extent do you identify with the other team members, etc.? We asked them about how prototypical their leader was for their team. To what extent does your leader represent the values and norms of your team? To what extent is your leader a good example of what it means to be a team member, etc.? And we measured leaders' fairness. So to what extent does your leader act fairly? To what extent does your leader have your voice and have you participate in important decision-making processes? And what we found was the expected three-way interaction between identification, prototypicality, and fairness. And the interaction showed that for the highly identified group members, prototypicality was more important than fairness. So if you are strongly identified, you care about your leader representing the group well and not so much about whether the leader is fair or not. And we did the same in this paper in 2009. We did the same in an experiment. We surveyed students in Marburg University, and we first selected those who said that they would support or vote for the Green Party. So we only had Green Party supporters in our sample. We asked them about their identification with the Green Party, and we manipulated in a scenario study fictitious leaders' prototypicality and fairness. We manipulated prototypicality by saying this leader either has a background in sociology and has worked in a culture club, or we said this leader has a background in economics and works for a business organization. So the latter leader for a Green Party should be less prototypical than the sociologist working in some culture area. And we manipulated fairness by saying, recently this leader made a decision for allowing a highway being built, so something that a Green Party member would not typically like. And we said either this leader made this decision alone and without consulting the party members, or we said this leader made this decision after having consulted party members and having listened to their arguments. And again, we found the same three-way interaction for those who were more strongly identified with the Green Party. Prototypicality mattered more than fairness. So I think the paper's title is something like Substitute for Fairness, and we said, of course it would be good to be fair, but those leaders who cannot be fair for some reasons can substitute it when they are prototypical. Okay, so that's the typical research. And now recently there has been a meta-analysis with 29 studies, and that all show that leader group prototypicality is important and contributes to leader ratings of effectiveness and support and trust and all these things. But Heslem and colleagues said, okay, but there should be more than just prototypicality, and together we identified three more aspects of identity leadership. And these aspects we call identity advancement, identity impresarioship, and identity entrepreneurship. Those who are interested, I can send a paper or give you some references. And essentially it's about what the leader does to create a strong group identity. Does a leader set the structures that we can feel as sitting in one boat? Does a leader emphasize what it means to be a group member? Does a leader defend our team from demands of the larger organization or other teams? And if leaders do that, then they can be seen as effective even if they are not prototypical. Because the problem with prototypicality is that even if it's flexible, as I said, for some people it's difficult to be prototypical. And these people not only have difficulties in gaining leadership positions, but also often are victims of bullying or mobbing. Typical situations are the only women in the fire service, or the only woman in the police. These women are often victims of mobbing or bullying. But you can see it also the other way around, probably the only male teacher in a primary school. These people have more difficulties to be seen more prototypical, and therefore, traditionally, when we only focus on prototypicality, are less likely to be effective as leaders. However, with this more new approach, we think that prototypicality can also be substituted. And my best example is Ursula von der Leyen. Remember when Ursula von der Leyen became Secretary of Defense 4 or 5 years ago? She didn't have any history of being related to the army or being seen as a military person, and she clearly was not prototypical for that job. She was the first woman in this position anyway, but her whole career, her whole history was on social affairs and family. I think she was Secretary of Family Affairs first in Niedersachsen and then in the Bund for many, many years. And as a woman, she also was portrayed as very feminine, always being portrayed as a mother of 7 children and someone who took care of her elderly father, etc. And now she came into this new job in which she was not prototypical. Remember what she did in the first years of office? She tried to make the Bundeswehr a family-friendly employer. She introduced childcare into the German army. She introduced a new system of rotating officers around. For 40 years or 50 years, every officer in the German army had to move to a different location every 2 years, just because it was a requirement in the army. And she changed it and said, we only do that if it makes sense for the job these people are doing. Otherwise, they can remain in one location because it's much better for them also having a family and a family life. And she did this for good reasons, because you know, after we abolished the Wehrpflicht, the mandatory service, the German army had big problems recruiting soldiers. But also, by doing this, she very cleverly changed the identity of the army a little bit into a direction in which she now all of a sudden became more prototypical, because she represented these family issues very well. And after that, she turned to the really serious problems, like corruption in the weapon systems and these things. So she made herself more prototypical by changing the agenda, and then she could start being an effective leader in the position in which she was responsible for. Okay. I also did some research with many colleagues like Jan Wieseke or Giles Hurst or Michael Hearn, in which we also followed a different model of identity leadership. And we looked at the identity transfer and looked at whether leaders' extent to which they identify with group would eventually have positive outcomes such as followers' satisfaction or performance, because leaders' identification trickles down or is contagious and picked up or catched by followers, so that when leaders strongly identify with their teams and organizations, followers will also identify more with their teams and organization, and then this follower identification has positive effects on followers' attitudes and behaviors. And we did these studies in four or five, we did this research in four or five studies. In these two papers, I think we published five studies, and we have done a few more in the health industry, in the pharmaceutical industry, in the travel industry, in schools in Germany and elsewhere, and we consistently found the model supported. We also found it supported in one study across three different layers of hierarchy. That was a study in the travel industry, in which we surveyed, I think, 30 regional directors, 300 managers of 300 travel agencies, and 1,000 employees. And we found that the regional directors' identification trickled down to the managers, and the managers' identification trickled down to the employees. And in that study, we also have a measure of performance, in which we had mystery shoppers go into the 300 travel agencies asking for a standardized service, and directly after they left the travel agency, they rated the service they got on three or four items. And we show that the higher the leaders, the regional director's identification, the better the outcome, mediated via the identification of managers and employees. But obviously, all this research is survey research. So we ask leaders, are you identified? We ask followers, are you identified? And typically, we then also ask followers about their own satisfaction or self-reported citizenship behaviors or performance or other things. So you may also think that either follower satisfaction, for example, may also influence whether they identify or not. And when I'm a leader of a team in which 10 people identify strongly, then probably the leader is also more likely to identify with that team than the other way around. Or you may think maybe it's third variables that influence both leader and follower identification, such as the financial turnover of the organization. If it's a rich organization that is doing well on the stock market, probably both leaders and followers are more identified than when it's a poor organization. We try to control for all sorts of things in our survey studies. So, for example, we try to control in the travel agency study for the location. Was the travel agency in a big shopping mall or rather in a small city? In the study with the school teachers, we controlled for school type, we controlled for the size of the school, etc. But obviously, you can never control for every factor, and there may be third variables that we were not able to control for. That's why we went into the laboratory and we did two studies, and I will show you one of these studies. And we published it in 2010, and it was actually data from an expra, that we conducted here in Frankfurt. We had 34 participants, obviously, psychology students in the second semester or so. We got them into our laboratory, and we divided them in two groups. And we told them, okay, your task is to build little towers of Lego in three-person groups. And what we are interested in is whether people build differently when they use different colors to disguise the real nature of our experiment. No one believed us that we were interested in colors, but it was good enough to draw their attention to different things than the one that we manipulated. Always two participants showed up in the laboratory, where a third participant was always waiting for them, and this third participant obviously was always a research confederate of us. Then we drew a lot, and surprise, surprise, the confederate was always assigned the leader role, and the other two were always assigned the follower roles. And the followers were then building towers from Lego. And the leader had nothing else to do than give instructions and take the time. And in the one condition, we said the leader was highly identified, and in the other condition, we said the leader was less highly identified. How did we do that? In the one condition, the leader made standardized statements, two statements. One statement was, "We are good and we will be winning." And in the other condition, he said, "You are good and you are winning." So in the one condition, the leader included himself as a member of the team by saying "we." In the other condition, he was also very positive, used the exact words, except that he said "you," and by doing that, excluded himself from being a member of this team. And this is basically the manipulation check. So afterwards, we asked participants, the two participants, to what extent do you think that your leader identified with the team? And you see that there was quite a large effect. So these statements made the leader appear being one of us and being seen as highly identified. We found that participants' own identification was also highly significantly different in the two conditions. So it was the same task, same job, same setup. They get the same amount of Versuchspersonenstunden for participating in the experiment. But you see this small manipulation of the leader, including the "we" or "not" into his statements, led to a significantly higher identification in this condition. And we found that on average, the participants in the high identification condition used 8 more Lego bricks. And this difference is marginally significant. So it's not highly significant, it's not a huge difference, but we do find what we wanted to find. And we also did some mediation analyses and found that the effect of condition on the difference in performance was mediated by the difference in identification. So I think this is very important research on leadership being a group process. So whether you focus on prototypicality or leader's own identification or the other factors, advancement, etc., that I just suggested, does not matter so much. But now I think hardly anyone would deny that effective leaders need to be attuned to what the group is about. And it's very, very difficult to lead a group without connect to the group's identity. That's what we sometimes see in mergers and acquisitions, when two groups get together that do not share an identity and the leaders are not trusted because they do not share an identity. And on the other hand, we see many examples of where leaders are particularly effective when they create groups with strong identities. For example, in sports. And another area that we look into is transformational leadership for the last 15 years or so, and this has been consistently also been found as a key factor that differentiates between effective and less effective leaders. Traditionally, leadership is about transactions. The leader sets a goal and then rewards people for achieving the goal or punishes people for not achieving the goal. And obviously, to be able to reward or punish people, these leaders also need to monitor the day-to-day activities. They do not only need to set the goal, but they have to monitor goal achievement, goal accomplishment, and give feedback along the line. And this is what leaders probably do in 80% of the time, and this is good. And transactional leadership has been shown to be effective. Not super effective, but effective. But we live in a world in which there's constant crisis, in which there's constant change, and people are ambivalent and ambiguous about what will happen and what we will do next year, and how do I solve these complex tasks? And to help with this, leaders need to be transformational and not only transactional. They do not only need to have this transaction in form, you do this and then I will give you that. But followers want to hear, why are we here? What is your vision as a leader? What is our purpose, our mission? And this is called transformational leadership. So it's like charisma. Leaders who have a strong vision, they can communicate this vision well, they can stimulate and inspire people so that they believe that if we perform well, then our team will have a good future, not only now, but in the next 10 years or so. And if I had a video here, I would show you a little video of Moby Dick. That's a very nice clip. I don't know whether you remember the book or have seen the movie. The old movie from the 1950s with Gregory Peck nicely illustrates these two types of leadership. And it also is a good example that leaders can be both. They can act transactionally and can act transformationally. The best leaders are able to do both and to decide when is transactional leadership necessary and when is it needed to be more transformational. And in this, you all know the story that Captain Ahab wants to search for and kill the white whale, the Moby Dick. And there's one scene in the old movie in which Captain Ahab promises his crew a gold Spanish doubloon for the one person who sees the white whale first, and he nails the Spanish doubloon on the boat's mast. And when the first person saw the white whale, he took the doubloon and gave it to this man, and then promised even more, and promised that when we find the white whale and kill him, I promise you 10% of my profit of this voyage. And then he even goes further and says, and I promise you every drop of white whale's blood will be another Spanish doubloon for you, for the crew. And then you see how these people stand there and look at him. And they do not really understand. For them, it's just crazy. We are whale catchers, and there are so many whales around us. Why do we have to look for some white whale? Why do we have to go all these long distance to find this one white whale? And they do not really understand and are indecisive of whether they want to do that or not, because in this situation, this transaction is not enough. It's not enough to promise some more money if you are going to very unsure, uncertain paths. And then Captain Ahab switches to this transformational style, and he uses metaphors like taking out harpoons from a cabinet and saying to the blacksmith, "Blacksmith, forge me these weapons." and then melt them down, but we will not douse them in water. They shall have a proper baptism. Man, will you give enough blood that is needed to temper the steel? And then he goes around to his crew and uses other metaphors. Be the corpse that fit my wheels. Be the torch that sets my light. And then he uses a large cup and drinks of it and swears to death of Moby Dick. And then you see how his crew gets stares in their eyes and all drink from the cup, like a ritual symbol, like a religious ritual in church. And this then brings the people on board and makes them go after the white whale. And you all know where the story ended. Except one, they were all killed. So it's not necessarily that effective leaders are good leaders, but they are more effective in the goals that they want to pursue. And I don't know whether you know the German left-wing terrorists, the RAF. They used Herman Melville's novel as their guidebook. So the white whale was the Bundesrepublik Deutschland, the pig state, and they gave each other names from the book. So it has a huge impact and can be used as a metaphor. And you can see the RAF leaders also as transformational leadership or transformational leaders who also spoke with metaphors and to get their people's support. Yes, please.
So could you say that transformational leaders somehow induce intrinsic motivation and transactional leaders more
extrinsic? Not only, but of course the transactional leadership is mostly about extrinsic rewards, getting something for achieving what you needed to achieve. It does not always need to be money, but the focus is on something to get out of the deal and transaction. Whereas transformational leadership are effective because they help people accepting why we are here for and what we do, what we need to do. Yes? Thanks. Okay, so let's switch to group decision making. Sometimes we can predict very accurately from the pre-discussion distribution of opinions in the group the outcome, the decision that the group take. Particularly when we know the decision-making rule that prevails in the group at the time. And I show you a few examples of this type of research. And I think the last multiple choice question of today related to what we discussed last week already showed us that group decision-making or group brainstorming is typically less effective than individual brainstorming, and partly so because of coordination problems. When one person speaks, the other cannot speak. When one person speaks, the other person may get interrupted in their own creative thinking, but part of it also is due to motivation problems, social loafing. However, if you do these exercises, even on which items commence with the letter W, and you have nominal groups and real groups, and in the nominal groups, each of the three people need to write down their answers individually. In the real group, they have to announce their answers. And even if we consistently, over and over, show that the real group would perform less well than the nominal group, people still think they are better in the real group. And one factor of, or one factor that explains this illusion that the group is more effective may be due to distorted perceptions during the task, and others may be related to just enjoying being in a group more. And this is something I think I mentioned last week. Often people join groups because they can achieve more in a group than they can achieve alone and individually. But even if it's not the case, people like to be around others. People do not want to be isolated and alone. So this need And the need satisfaction in group maybe contributes to sometimes an illusion that the group is better than individuals are. But another factor is distorted perceptions. And I like this finding from Wolfgang Ströbe's research. They did this typical nominal group versus real group brainstorming. And after the brainstorming was over, they presented each non-redundant idea again to each member of the nominal or the real group and asked them, was this idea suggested by you? Was this idea thought by you but suggested by someone else? Or was it not? Did you not think about the idea during the brainstorming task? And what you can see is that there is this big difference of people in nominal groups saying, no, this idea was not thought by me, compared to people in the real group, because people in the real group think much more often that, oh, I thought also of this idea, but it was just that someone else mentioned it. So in a group situation, particularly a brainstorming situation, you more often think when someone speaks and announces an idea, oh yeah, I just saw this. And this gives you the illusion that you are more effective in the group. So it's a distortion of your perception. Yes, please. So, a nominal group is, I have three people and I tell them, please write down your ideas individually. And in a real group, the three groups openly announce the ideas, and then afterwards I compare the non-redundant ideas of the three individuals with the three real group. Sometimes groups, and particularly groups that are well established, that are together for some time, have something that is called a transactive memory structure. And this makes groups often being more effective than individuals when it's about remembering information. And this can be very good. So groups can devise very clever strategies for who keeps which types of memory active in their minds. And you may know from your learning groups or from other groups that this is often the case, particularly in groups that are together for a longer time. So you have people who have different expertises, and this expertise can be used by the other team members, and they can afford to not memorize or not think of particular things. So that sometimes helps groups making better decisions. Sometimes, however, groups also make less good decisions. And one factor that has been studied by social psychology is groupthink. And this has been found to apply particularly to very cohesive groups that have a strong and directive leader. And the main factor is that there is this overzealous desire to reach consensus. So in a highly cohesive group, people want to reach consensus, and they do not want to deviate from the group's opinion. And therefore, and particularly if there's strong leadership, sometimes groups go into the wrong direction. This has been studied by Irvin Yanis, published in first in the 1960s, but 1982 is a classic book about it. And he analyzed all the protocols from the Kennedy administration's decision to invade the Bay of Pigs on Cuba, which was a huge disaster for the US American army and politics in general. And this was the exact situation in which there was a strong leader, President Kennedy, with a highly cohesive group of his closest consultants sitting together in a closed room under time pressure, and they had to make this decision relatively quickly. And although people later on said that they thought it was not a clever idea, they didn't dare to say it. They didn't dare to raise their concerns or issues because they felt that consensus was needed. So when there's a strong leader and the group acts under stress, group members are more concerned with being accepted by the groups than making the best decision, being correct. And then group members censor themselves. They do not search for all the information available. They do not evaluate the evaluation that is on the table in an unbiased way. They don't raise concerns or issues because they feel that consensus is needed. And this is what Yannis suggested. So the consequences of poor decision making, inadequate consideration to objectives, the group does not adequately study alternative actions or solutions, does not fully examine the risks of the alternative that is on the table, does not search for all the information, does not evaluate the information in an unbiased way, does not have a plan B or other contingency plans that says, okay, we would invade Cuba, but only if Fidel Castro does this and this and that before. So all of this is poor decision making. And it results from a setting in which a group is highly cohesive, close to outside opinions. Often they are physically sitting in one designated room or area that is close to outside information or opinions, has a strong and directive leader, does not have systematic procedures to evaluate alternatives. You all know Kahneman, Daniel Kahneman. You all know Kahneman. Kahneman, together with Amos Tversky, won the Nobel Prize for Economics in 2000 or 1995 or so, as the first psychologist who won this prize for their research on the anchoring bias, anchoring effects. And Kahneman wrote, published a book, Fast Thinking, Slow Thinking, a couple of years ago, that was a bestseller. And in this book, he describes how he consults organizations or public administrations. And think about things like the Berlin Airport or the Elbphilharmonie or other things that so terribly, obviously, went over budget and take much, much longer than planned. And Kahneman says, okay, the next time you do an important decision on a project like this, you make your decision just the way you always make it. But then spend 10 minutes on another exercise. And this exercise is, imagine in 5 years from now, the project would not have gone as we would have hoped or expected. Imagine in 5 years from now, the budget was exceeded, there were some delays, or there were some unexpected effects on the environment or whatever. Imagine this situation just for 5 minutes, and then get back into the group and decide whether you stick to your decision or not. If you still stick to your decision, fine, go along with it. But maybe this little exercise helps you interrupting this not looking for alternatives, etc. So all of these factors lead to a strong desire for group consensus. And the characteristics of this is that the group feels invulnerable, it assumes a morally high position, it discounts challenges and rationalizes their own position, stereotypes opponents, group members do not express their doubts, and when no one is expressing their doubts, then the others are assuming that they agree with the proposed solution, and that leads to the illusion of unanimity, that we are all on the same level. One very interesting research in which this has been shown is the Chernobyl catastrophe in 1986, when the nuclear power plant in the Ukraine exploded. This was a model, an example situation of groupthink. It was a situation in which Russian engineers had to make decisions. And Russian engineers were highly cohesive groups. They were feeling invulnerable because they were seen as the elite of the Soviet Union. Working in nuclear power plants was highly esteemed positions. They were well trained. And I think it was on the day before 1st of May or so, and power demand in the whole country was very high. But for some reasons, the administration has taken the decision to run a test on the Chernobyl reactor so that it had to reduce their power. And in a nuclear power plant, how can you reduce power? By taking out some of the nuclear elements of the water basin, producing heat and power. But what the engineers, because they were working in an isolated situation under high time pressure, they had this feeling of invulnerability, and there was strong leadership. The chief engineer was acting like a king in some ways. So those engineers who raised their concerns or doubts were not listened to, and then there was this feeling of unanimity, and they continued with the test even if the protocols show that they should have realized much, much earlier that something went wrong. So what did they do? They removed the nuclear things from the water basin, and then the automatic procedure said that we need less water to cool the whole system so that it put less water into the remaining nuclear things, and they did not get cooled as much as they needed. And the response was not to reintroduce the others and reintroduce water, but to take off even more of the nuclear things so that the automatic system even reduced the volume of the pumps pumping cold water into the system even more, and then very, very quickly the whole system completely got out of control. It was published in a German journal, Umweltpsychologie, and I think the main authors are Hofinger and Reck. Maybe you should have a look and search for it. The German journal Umweltpsychologie, a couple of years ago, and it's a very, very interesting article describing step by step what happens and using groupthink as the underlying theoretical basis for the analysis. This is what you often find in textbooks, a recipe against groupthink. Have the leader remain impartial and encourage the expression of dissent. So if you are Kennedy and you need to make this decision, do we invade Cuba or not, then do not say your own preferred opinion before the others do. And openly express dissent. That means, for example, tell people around the table, okay, please, each one writes down what they would like to do, yes or no, and then we make a round and everyone says whether they would do it or not, and please be not concerned about unanimity. I want to have your open expressions, or stimulate people to express their dissent. What do you think? Do you really think it? Are there other options, etc.? And then there are other suggestions. For example, you should split down the group into two different or more subcommittees to discuss the same issue separately, or to appoint a devil's advocate who always argues against the mainstream, or to consult outside experts. This all makes sense in terms of this model that Yanis has found, but why do you think I put these exclamation marks behind the suggestions 2, 3, and 4. What might be the danger or the risk in appointing a devil's advocate or having subcommittees? Yes, please. It has to do with identities, yeah? And if I split the group in too many subcommittees, then there's no identity anymore. But I think there's even more a danger of a subcommittee or an outsider or a devil's advocate increasing groups' identity so much that this person, the devil's advocate, the outside expert, or the one dissenting subcommittee, these are not seen as group members anymore, and therefore you don't listen to the arguments even less than you would do if you see the devil's advocate as one group member who raises their concerns. So I would be careful with this, but the first suggestion clearly and certainly is a good suggestion. Sometimes group members or groups also make poor decisions, not because of groupthink phenomena, but because we have preferences to look for information that validates our initial preference. So groups have the potential to make better decisions than individuals, but often they don't do that. And one area in which this has been studied intensively is the so-called hidden profile paradigm. And the main researchers here are Felix Brodbeck. He's now at the LMU in Munich. And Stefan Schulz-Hart, who is at Göttingen University. They have done, I don't know, dozens of studies and published very influential papers, both in the management and in the basic social psychology field, about the hidden profile paradigm. So that's a very simple illustration of the hidden profile situation. Imagine you are a member of a group. You are group member X, Y, or Z, and you are given two candidates to be evaluated, and your decision is to appoint one of them. And each of you has some information about the candidates. And typically in a hidden profile, the information is distributed unevenly across the group members. So group member X, and let's say all this information is positive, to make it simple. Of course, in a hidden profile study, there would also be more than two candidates, there may be three or four candidates, and there may be positive and negative information for each candidate on your list of characteristics for each candidate. But let's make it simple, all of these informations are positive. So group member X has two positive informations about candidate A and three positive information about candidate B. The same is true for group member Y, two positives about A, three positives about B, and the same is true for group member Z. So you are one of these group members, you read through all this information, and you decide on which candidate would you appoint. And then you get together as a group, and you are allowed to discuss everything and take as much time as is as needed. And then at some stage, you have to make a group decision which of the candidates to appoint. And what it would typically find is that the group does not recognize that if group members would exchange all this information, they would find that there are three different pieces of information for candidate A, which in sum lead to four positive pieces of information for candidate A, but that the three information for candidate B are the same for all group member, and therefore in sum only make three. which should lead to a group decision if they would exchange all the information objectively and freely. On a group basis, they should decide for candidate A rather than for candidate B. And we almost nowhere find that groups make this better decision. And why is this? Because group members do not realize that this is the case because they don't talk about these pieces of information. Either they don't talk about them at all, or they talk about them briefly but then switch to the pieces of information that they share. So there's a preference to discuss shared information rather than unshared information. And it's almost impossible to interrupt this process, because as soon as you are group member X and you read the information, you form a preference for B. And whenever group member Y or Z mention item 2, 3, or 1 about group member B, they immediately would say, yes, I also have this. And sometimes groups say, okay, let's individually, who do you prefer, who do you prefer, who do you prefer, and then they discuss anything. They just say, okay, then let's go for B, it seems simple. If they don't do that and say, ah, but let's have a moment and discuss the information, they focus on this rather than that. The only possibility to interrupt this is telling the group, it's not your job to make a decision. It's your job to collapse all the information so that someone else can then make a better informed decision. Then group members realize that there are more information about the alternative candidates. Okay. And I would recommend, if you haven't read or seen it, 12 Angry Men in the movie with Henry Fonda about group decision making in a jury. It's a brilliant movie, and it's also a brilliant movie about minority influence. The minority is consistent, and as soon as the minority of one gets a first supporter, then a minority can actually be very strong. Thank you very much. See you next week.